In Scotland, when friends get together, they blether. When these three friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions. Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues that are live and happening in Scotland right now. We hope that you'll join us. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether.
And you could also join in our blethers on social media. You can find us as at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcast and would love it if you could share them with your friends and leave a review on the platform of your choice.
Hello and welcome to episode 77 of Scottish Blethers. I'm Liz Lister.
And I'm Helen Houston.
And this is part two because in last week's episode, we looked at the very happy topics of hatches and matches. That was births and marriages. And this week, we're finishing off the trilogy with dispatches, which is a bit gloomier.
It's a bit gloomier, but actually, Liz, when we go through it, there's some quite interesting things and quite unique types of superstitions, etc., and routines and rituals attached to dispatches or deaths, as we know it.
Yeah, I mean, like all over the world, the rituals that are associated with death, Scotland is no exception. And although death can sometimes be a bit of a taboo subject, as Benjamin Franklin said when he was talking about the new constitution that he'd just written for the United States, everything seems to promise it will be durable, but in this world, nothing is certain except death and taxes.
So true, isn't it? So true. And as I say, we're coming up to the end of our tax year, Liz, so we'll be looking to our taxes thinking, well, we've got to do it.
Yes, unfortunately. Yes, but today the subject is death. And looking at some of the practices in Scottish history going way back in time, and there were some really fascinating superstitions and the practice of death and burial. And many of them are still in place today, particularly as you go up to more remote areas up in the Highlands and Islands.
Yes, and some of the things that the things that were symbols, I remember, and I was very, very young, very much preschool, that my mother had got some flowers and she put them in the window, red and white flowers she'd put in the window, and my granny was horrified. She said, oh, you can't do that. And the scary thing was that my mother's twin brother was killed that day in South Africa. So, I've always thought that omen of death, white and red flowers mixed together, you never do, completely taboo.
Yeah, the other one that I always remember is lilac, which is beautiful. You know, it's a beautiful scent, but very unlucky to bring lilac into the house. And primroses, which seems really unusual, but lots of omens of death.
Yes, and the ticking in the house, the ticking clock, and I always think of that old song, my grandfather's clock stood so long on the shelf, tick-tock, never to go, and he stopped when the old man died. I think that is part of that omen of death, isn't it?
It's not just watches or clocks as well. A tap dripping or three drops of cold blood falling from the nose. My goodness,
Oh, I think we'll move on, Liz, shall we?
A dog howling, a cock crowing, and then a tingling sound in the ears.
Right, well, deed bells, as they say, the deed bells.
Yeah, yes, and no luck if you've got tinnitus.
Maybe it feels like death if you've got that real annoying thing going on.
Yeah, another thing that's really interesting in Scotland is the words that we use when we're talking about death. You know, we say that somebody passed, you know, that's the sort of modern way of saying it. But traditionally, people would have said he slipped a wah, meaning that he died peacefully. Or if it was a real fight at the end, he won a wah. That means he suffered and he won release towards the end. So slipped a wah and won a wah are words that we would use.
But I like also the expression, or not like the expression, but where they're trying to explain what people died from, the did we old age or did we a fever, you know, death, dead with something.
Yeah, instead of saying died of or died from, you know, so the my mum, she talks about he died with the COVID. She calls it the COVID. He died with the COVID.
Well, I suppose the way they're recording deaths with COVID at the moment, it's not always necessarily that they died from COVID, but they died with COVID on their medical certificate 28 days before that.
Yeah, that's very true. Never thought of it like that, but that is very true. Yeah. And of course, death or passing onto a new life is one of these liminal phases that I'm so fond of, this time between the real world and the spiritual world. And like the births and the marriages, at this time, the spirit of the deceased had to be protected. And as we'll find out in this week's episode, it wasn't just protecting it from the spirit world and evil spirits who might get hold of it. It also had to be protected on occasions from the living world as well. But we'll come on to that.
And of course, life on Earth was short. There was a very strong belief in the afterlife. So you had to kind of pass through this purgatory on the way to either heaven or hell. And of course, you always hoped that you're going to eternity in heaven, ascend to heaven or be damned to hell.
Yeah, that was if you were poor. If you were rich, you were okay, because you could afford to pay priests and monks. You could give them a stipend to get them to say mass on behalf of your deceased and your relatives. You could build a chapel or a chantry. So there you had the fast track to heaven through purgatory. You paid for indulgences if you'd slipped up and carried out the odd sin or two. But if you were just the ordinary people of the world, it was a completely different thing. And if you think about it, in those days, I mean, stonemasons in Edinburgh, they used to say old by 20, dead by 30.
Yes. And of course, some of the things that with this idea of building these chapels or the, you know, parts of churches, we have benefited because we've got wonderful, wonderful churches and chapels. I'm thinking, Liz, in particular of Roslyn Chapel down just outside Edinburgh, which was, of course, started by William Sinclair because he felt if he built this beautiful church, he would get a fast track into heaven. But and he did. He built a beautiful church. But you know, two generations on, his family said, hey, come on, we've spent a lot of money on this. We'll stop now.
Yeah. And of course, the people who were getting rich on the back of all these wealthy people paying for the perpetual prayers and indulgences and pilgrimages and all the rest of it was the Catholic Church. And of course, that was the beginning of the Reformation.
Yes. Just thinking that you could always hear the Reformation coming along, thinking there's a lot of money being spent here, and a lot of poor people. But yes, but the Calvinist Church took the view that you confession and the last rites were just not necessarily, they were not necessary for salvation. You know, you could do other things. You didn't need to spend all that money on the church.
Yeah, basically it was cutting out the middleman. You know, that they believed, and in Scotland, the church really got the bit between their teeth and went for the whole kit and caboodle when it came to Reformation. So we had people like John Knox preaching from the pulpit and condemning anything that was to do with the Catholic Church. So they wanted simplicity. As you say, they wanted to abolish masses. They wanted the individual to be able to talk to God direct.
I always have this talking to God direct, like you say, Liz. I have this image of everybody with their mobile phones. You know, yeah, just going, look, I don't need a middleman. I can go direct. I've got a direct
hotline. Hotline. But yes. The Calvinists, the Reformed Church, they believed that all were equal in death, and so that everything should be very simple. So that when somebody died, there should be nothing superstitious or ceremonial about the process. They wanted to emphasise simplicity.
Now, and I think there's a lot to be said for that, Liz. You know, there's a lot to be said for that, that you can just, you know, just have it simple but respectful.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for the simple life, you know, that the word that would be used in the church would be douce. You know, the Presbyterian was a douce church. They rejected all flumgummery, as they called it, superfluous or extravagant show.
These are really good words you're coming out with, Liz, in the midst of our chat rather than at the end. That's good. But no, it was you know, very much a thing. And one of the things that the rituals associated with death, very similar to the rituals associated with birth, the fact that all the windows and doors were opened, you know, to let out the evil, let the spirits get out, you know, from the church to go from the house to go to where they had to be in the next life.
And a strange one, but any fire in the room where the deceased was being kept had to be extinguished. I don't know why that was, but they weren't allowed to have a fire. And another strange one was that it was considered taboo for a dog or a cat to enter the room. So I don't know what the aversion to animals around the corpse was.
No, it just seems strange. And then, of course, we know the thing about of the eyelids, putting an old penny laid over the eyes to keep the eyelids closed. And I think that, I don't know if that still goes on now, it won't be a penny, but it might be just something that they put over the eyes.
One that I remember my mum telling me about was that it was a regular practice that visitors would come to touch the corpse, because this was believed to safeguard individuals against illness and disease and to stop bad dreams. But my mum remembers when her grandpa died, she was taken into the room and made to touch his face. Now, I don't know about protecting against bad dreams, but children were terrified.
Yes, that's very scary, yes. But then there's other things, you know, that when somebody dies, and you know, not like today, but in the old days, people were dying in their own homes, you know, in their own beds or whatever. So something had to be done, and they were normally kind of stretched out on a board, weren't they? And there'd be planks or boards kept for that purpose, even in the village or in the church, to be hired out, to be given out for people to use.
I think that when we talk about these rituals, there's huge divisions, first of all, between the affluent and the poor, but also between the Highlands and the Lowlands of Scotland. So probably the most extreme was probably the Highlands, where the poverty was. So as you said, they wouldn't have been able to waste money creating a coffin or a mort kiss, a dead chest is what they called a coffin. They would just have used a board, as you say, and they would have stretched the corpse out on the board.
And what's interesting, and the mort cloth that went over it, but what's interesting is that if you're trying to research, you know, your ancestry or where people were buried, going right back into the, you know, before the 1800s, the 1700s, if you go into the parish records and look at the records of the hiring out of these mort boards or mort cloths, that helps you identify or give you dates of when people might have died, especially if the gravestone is obliterated, you know, had been weathered away. You can use those records.
It was tradition that the younger women in the family would spin these deed clathes, these mort cloths, these pieces of homemade linen, and keep them ready. But if the family couldn't afford that, then, as you say, they rented them from the church, and the proceeds that the church raised renting out these mort boards and mort cloths went to relieve poverty in the parish.
That's right. I remember my grandmother's kitchen in Dundee. The big dresser with the big drawer at the bottom of the dresser in the kitchen. We weren't allowed to go near that drawer. Too heavy for us to pull out anyway. But I think that's where the shroud was kept.
Yeah, I've never really understood the shrouds, because I inherited one as well from my gran's linen cupboard. But it's like a table runner. That's what I thought it was. So I'm not quite sure how these relate to the deed clays that we're talking about here. Obviously, it sort of evolved.
No, I think it is different, Liz, because I think that the shrouds, the things that you and I are thinking of, that was probably laid out over the coffin, you know, when the coffin was on display. And then, of course, at one time, before they went to the funerals, the funeral procession, the coffin would be laid on two chairs outside the door and then be taken from there to the graveyard or the kirkyard. And it was tradition that the chairs would then be toppled over once the coffin had been raised off them to let people know that they were away to the churchyard.
Yeah, and I mean, in the case of, you know, the poor, they didn't even put the mort clays into the grave, because they were going to be used again. So it was literally just the corpse on a board that was put into it. And up in the Highlands, very often you'll get what's referred to as the Coffin Road. You maybe heard of Peter May's book, The Coffin Road. And that was because in parts of the Highlands and Islands, this, particularly out on the islands, the Western Isles, the soil is so thin that perhaps they had to walk quite a way carrying the coffin to be able to get to the Macher, the area between the land and the sea, where there was enough sandy soil to get a depth where they could actually bury the corpse.
Well, that's right. And that's why for many of these wonderful beaches around the Western Isles, there is always a kind of a track down to the beach, because that track was there for the graveyard, which is just beside the beach.
Yeah, and you know, as you travel around the Western Isles, so many beautiful little graveyards, or as we would call them, kirkyards, because traditionally they would have been at the side of the church, and they're all looking out to sea. So I always wondered why they were at the coast, but that's why, because that's where the soil is thicker.
To get a depth of soil, which of course, I'm thinking of where we are, Liz, in Salon here, the old kirkyard, some of the gravestones there look as if they've been kind of buried, or they were just very, very mean, very small. But in actual fact, they would just keep piling up the earth as more and more burials were required. As one lot had been finished, they would just keep burying them up. So you'll get basically just like the top, the pediment of a headstone peeking out through the surface, because there's been, you know, graves built above it, earth built above it. And the wall round many of these old kirkyards was built specifically to hold the extra soil that was going in as more and more people were being buried.
Yeah, that's a good Scottish word that you raised there, Helen. Layer, L-A-I-R.
Yes.
It literally does mean layer, L-A-Y-E-R. And we would call, you know, we would have a plot. In English, it would be called a burial plot, but we call it a layer. And it's an interesting story, because my father-in-law, Archie, was 94 when he died, but he came from a very long-lived family. And there was only two places left in the family lair. And Archie was terrified that somebody would die before him and get that plot. So when my mother-in-law died, he had her put in to the family plot lair so that he ensured the last place. And he was quite happy. But that was it. His was guaranteed. The rest of the family were not happy. they were well, sisters, so they took the less precedence. So Archie had his place by dint of his wife getting in there first. But another interesting thing about Archie's funeral was that he was a very, very high up Mason from the Masonic Lodge. And so, of course, the Masonic Lodge carry out their own rituals when it comes to the burial. So it was clear, like Men in Black, that there were people there at the funeral that were kind of hanging back at the end. You know, when we went out to the graveyard and the coffin was interred, and they were just kind of hanging back. So when everybody else left, they stepped forward and I hung back to see what was going on.
Yes.
And it was fascinating, because they put some kind of branch onto the coffin in the grave. And so I said to one of them, what is it? You know, what's the particular significance of the branch that you put on? Oh, we can't tell you, it's a secret. So I just came home and I googled it, and it's acacia. So I read all about it on Google. So what they won't tell you, you can find on Google.
Yeah. But it's interesting, because it's only relatively recently that women have been able to go to the graveyard, you know, at the funeral. I remember when my uncle died, that was in the 1970s, we all went to the church, but the women went on to the funeral tea while the men went to the graveyard where he was buried when the coffin was lowered in. And I also remember my father saying that he was always terrified at that graveyard, because it was on a very steep hill, and he said that on a wet, slippy day, he wondered how many people kind of slid sideways down the slope. But the person who was being interred had a wonderful view over the River Tee.
Very good. Well, even stranger than no women being allowed at the funeral, until the 18th century, the minister was only there in a private capacity, because funerals didn't take place in church. they took place in the homes, this going back to the Reformation, and the fact that there was no religious ceremony or salvation to be found in it. So it wasn't really until the end of the 18th century that ministers began to actually conduct the ceremony.
That seems very strange now, doesn't it? Because it's only recently, you know, that people have begun not having the funeral service in church and then the burial, that more and more people are just going straight to the crematorium or the, you know, in the undertaker's own hall having a service, or a hotel having the funeral service. So that's kind of almost as if we've jumped back a bit, where there's now celebrants instead of ministers in many cases.
And of course, before they ever got to the actual burial, a very important thing in Scotland was walking the dead, walking the corpse. And walking literally means watching. So again, this coming back to this area where the deceased was in danger before he got into the, or he or she got into the hands of God, there would be people who literally sat around the corpse watching it. And very often they would have a Bible to be able to protect them. If they didn't have one of their own, they could borrow one from the minister, and they would sit and watch.
Yes, and I think that too is because that, you know, with all our medical technological advances, they can be fairly certain when somebody is announced to be dead, you know, life has ceased, that it is correct. But in those days, going back to the 1700s, even into the 1800s, they couldn't be certain that your life was extinct. So sometimes it would just be a very deep coma that they would come through. And so a wee twitch or something. And quite often they would hold a piece of string tied to the pinky of the deceased and onto the pinky of the person who was watching, so that if the deceased twitched or whatever, it would jerk the string, and the watcher would know that.
Yeah, I think in this case, I agree that it was, you know, making sure that they were actually dead and departed, but it was also protecting their soul and stopping evil spirits from coming in. And while they were watching, another tradition that was both Highlands and Lowlands was that people, women usually, would stand over the deceased, and they were professional mourners. They would keen, K-E-E-N, which means lament and moan. You know, in the Lowlands, they were called sollies. And these were professional mourners who were dressed in black gowns and hoods, and they carried staves. And if your family was wealthy, this was the way of showing that how much the deceased had been loved and how much they would be missed. But up in the Highlands, it was just a traditional lament that they had in Gaelic. Still to this day, it goes on in some places called the Coronach.
Yes, and you sometimes when you're watching, you know, some of the terrible things that are happening around the world today, and you see these women lamenting and wailing, you think, well, that's what it would have been like, you know, in these villages and in the Highlands where a death had taken place.
Yeah, just an outpouring of grief, really. And of course, the Reformation, the Reformed Church, didn't have much time for that. It was much too showy. And so they banned it. But that's when the bagpiper began to come into the proceedings, and he would play keening songs, Highland laments, taking the place of these mourners.
And that's still very much a tradition today at funerals, especially in the Highlands. There will always be a bagpiper just playing the lament over the grave.
And one of my favourite pieces of bagpipe music, which is played equally at weddings and funerals, is Highland Cathedral, which has such significance to so many people, both happy times and sad times.
Yeah, I think the Fleurs of the Forest is the other one at funerals. It just kind of haunts, comes hauntingly out.
Yeah, it's the most appropriate instrument, isn't it? It is beautiful. It's haunting, yeah. And you can understand how it's taken the place of these keening songs.
Yes. But of course, Liz, you began to mention about the danger of, you know, protecting the body not just from evil spirits or, you know, whatever, but from people, and brings us into what was happening, the resurrectionists. These were the people who, in the days when the universities and their departments of anatomies, the medical students were given a limited number of, of bodies that they could practice their anatomy on or find out about their anatomy. And there was always looking for more. So there was a wee group of, you know, strange people grew up called the Resurrectionists, and they made quite a bit of money from the schools of anatomy by selling dead bodies that they dug up just after they had been buried to get to the Department of Anatomy. And there's all sorts of horrific tales about what was happening. But this gave rise to the, how were the family going to protect the body from being stolen by the Resurrectionists? And that was the mort safes coming into the kirkyards.
Yeah, I mean, luckily for the, you can imagine, you're wanting to protect your recently departed. And the worst thing that you can imagine is somebody, before they've made the passage to heaven, somebody digging them up. So you're going to do everything you possibly can to look after them. And the obvious thing to do is to have somebody stand guard over them in the kirkyard. And so if you look at many of the graveyards or kirkyards around Scotland, you'll see little towers in the corner, little houses which were built to so that somebody could stand duty and do a little circuit round the graveyard at night. Because once the body had been in the ground for a few days, it was no use to the Resurrectionists. So if you could look after it for a couple of days, a few days, then you were all right.
All was well, that you know, they were, the body could rest, literally rest in peace. But they did all sorts of things. You mentioned the towers, but they would also increase the walls around the cemetery just to stop people getting in. And then there was these mausoleums that were built as well within the graveyards with, you know, locked gates on them so that you just couldn't get in at all. And that's, I think, what makes a tour of a Scottish graveyard really interesting, looking at all these mausoleums, mort safes, and the mort houses, really.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned mort safe there. A mort safe went on top of the grave, and it was basically iron grid that you put over with a lock and key to stop anybody getting to the grave. And then once, after a few days, you were able to move it on to somebody else. But if you couldn't afford that, just a great big huge stone placed on top of the coffin, a mort stone, was good enough, place of the mort safe.
And then that all changed, Liz, didn't it, in 1832 with the Anatomy Act, which allowed legal provision of corpses or adequate provision of corpses to the medical schools.
And if you go into any kirkyard, you'll see the gravestones with their engravings on it. You might see the mort safe. But the one that I always think of when we're talking about this is Greyfriars Kirkyard in Edinburgh. And that has a story attached to it.
What, the ghost?
No, I'm thinking Birkenhair.
Oh, well, Birkenhair, yes. Out of the Grassmarket, they were navvies, Irish navvies, weren't they? Brought over from Ireland to dig the Union Canal. And one day, a lady who was sharing the same guest house as them died. So they took the body up the Department of Anatomy and found that they got more money for the body than they did in their wages for digging the Union Canal. So they set to looking for more bodies.
Yeah, people refer to them as Resurrectionists, but they were not Resurrectionists.
No, they were murderers.
Yeah, Hare had taken up with the owner of a guest house in the Westport in Edinburgh, and she was out of pocket because one of her residents had died, and you can't get money out of a corpse, or can you? So they decided that they would move the body along to the School of Anatomy. They filled up the coffin with bark, and nobody was any the wiser, and they were in pocket, so they waited for the next one to die, because the residents were quite elderly. But it wasn't happening fast enough, so they helped the process along, and they would take some of the residents out, they would get them drunk, bring them back, suffocate them with a pillow, and move them on to Dr. Knox at the School of Anatomy.
Yes, but I liked the way how this practice ended, as the, you could just imagine the picture, the corpse is lying on the anatomy table covered by a sheet, and the students and professors are all gathered round. The sheet is pulled back, and there's a sharp intake of breath from everybody. Everybody recognised this corpse. It was the local prostitute.
Yeah, so it led them back to Birkenhair, and Hare turned king's evidence. Burke was hanged, and he got his just desserts because his body went to the School of Anatomy as well.
That's right. And I think his skeleton is still there in the museum up on Chamber Street, isn't it? The Surgeon's Hall.
It is. And they've also got a death mask as well, which was another ritual where they would make a mask and paint it. And I think part of his skin was made into a purse, wasn't it?
Into purses and wallets. I think in antiques, in inverted commas, markets all over the world, you'll find a purse made out of Burke's skin.
A good story. And of course, when you think of mourning, you associate it with the colour black. In Scotland anyway, you know, if you think of mourning, black ties, suits nowadays, I always think up in the Highlands, people are much more strict in their wearing of the black tie, the white shirt, very smart, shoes polished. It's kind of got more casual down in the Lowlands. Yes. But the colour black, that came in the time of James V, which was the 16th century. And his wife, Queen Madeleine de Valois, his first wife, when she died, the Scottish royal court adopted black as high profile mourning. So 1537 was her death. That's when we started to adopt the colour black.
Yes, and it's interesting because when Mary, Queen of Scots, arrived back in Scotland after being widowed in France when she was just in her teens, she came in white because she was in her mourning white. So in France, it was still mourning white.
I think when we're talking about black and mourning, you know, it brings to mind, I love that painting by James Guthrie called The Highland Funeral. I love that because it's so evocative. You know, he was only 23 years of age when he painted it, and he had been sketching in the what's called the Trossachs of Scotland, which is the areas that's called the Highlands in miniature. It's between the Lowlands and the Highlands. Been sketching there at a place called Brig o' Turk, and a young boy had drowned, and this was his funeral, which was being held outside his family home. And in the way that he captures it, the grief and it's really evocative.
Oh, yes, you can stand in front. That's in Kelvin Grove,
yes,
isn't it?
Yep.
Art Gallery Museum. Yes, it's lovely. But the other thing I remember, Liz, I remember seeing them, is the mourning cards.
Yeah.
The notification of somebody's death and an invitation to their funeral that was sent out. These sort of like postcards, but they were bounded in black. You know, there was quite, you didn't want to get that envelope coming through the door.
No, you did not. And it was before you got that, it was the town crier, or it was the deed bells that were, you know, it was someone either hired by the church or by the local council to go out and to ring the bell to announce that someone had died and that there would be a funeral. And of course, the funeral was a huge thing because the family were supposed to do justice to the deceased, and sometimes it could put them into financial ruin.
Well, that's right. And apparently on Sky, when Flora MacDonald, that many of our listeners will have heard Flora MacDonald, the lady who rode Bonnie Prince Charlie over the sea to Sky, it says that for her shroud, she used the sheet from the bed that Bonnie Prince Charlie had slept in all these years before. But it said that, you know, the funeral was immense. More than a mile in length was the cortege, and several thousand of every rank on the island of Skye was at that funeral and the adjacent isles. So that must have been a huge thing in 1790. So it wasn't, you know, it was early days, but that must have been huge. And funerals nowadays, I saw one the other day in Stirling. I was walking down Allen Park, and there was the undertaker in his top hat and tails walking up the middle of the street, and the procession of funeral cars behind him going at his walking pace. He was obviously going to, I don't know how far he was going to walk, but some distance, I think.
Yeah, and you even begin to see coaches pulling the coffin, the hearse, and you know, acting as the hearse there. And it was traditional that it would be grey horses that pulled it. So, you know, a return to the old way of mourning. But, you know, you're talking about Flora MacDonald and all the people that turned up at her funeral. They must have had a good purvey.
Oh,
you must have known that there was a good purvey, because tradition was that when you had all these visitors coming, sometimes travelling great distances to mourn the dead, you had to supply them with food and drink.
And you still do, Liz. You still always have a funeral tea afterwards. And there's many places that you could book in for afternoon tea somewhere, or dinner, or lunch. You could actually book a place out for a funeral tea.
Yeah, my dad was very, very keen on one thing, that they wouldn't be given a ham sandwich. You know, so many of the funerals that he'd attended, it was a little curled up sandwich with a piece of boiled ham in the centre of it. He wanted to make sure that when people came to his funeral, they got a good meal.
A good meal.
That was what it was expected. But, you know, we're talking about how this, if people couldn't afford it, it could put them into poverty. So there was another tradition, which I think is lovely, which at the end of it, the guests knew that there was a particular duty that was expected of them. And that was literally the contents, you know, the remains, the last will and testament, everything that the person had left behind, they would be put up for sale. And all of the guests at the funeral would buy the contents of the home at a price that was much higher than it was actually worth. But this was their way of paying back and making sure that the relatives of the deceased were reimbursed.
I think that's a really nice tradition, isn't it? I hope they didn't leave the widow or the family homeless, you know, without anything in their house. I hope they would leave them something.
Well, even before that, the tradition was that all of the goods would be burned, that they would, that they weren't passed on from one generation to the next. They were burned after the owner died. But the one thing that they would never burn was a musical instrument. It always was passed down.
That's interesting. I was just thinking that I think my family will be following the tradition of burning everything. They've already told me, don't worry, Mum, there'll be a skip outside the door. Everything's going to the dump. So I'll tell them that it's tradition just to burn it. So save them the cost of a skip.
And of course, have you got a family lair?
No,
so
we don't.
You'll be getting burned as well.
I'll be getting burned, yes.
Yeah, that's a big division between the Highlands and the Lowlands because of shortage of space. You know that down in the urban areas, there just isn't enough room for graveyards or kirkyards or cemeteries, as they became known once they got taken over, because all these people were dying of diseases like the plague and typhoid and all the rest of it. When they were being buried in the centres of the towns, that was spreading the disease. And so it came from the time of Mary, Queen of Scots. She introduced it in the 16th century, that they would have cemeteries outside of the city centre. And of course, that became the norm. But today, down in the Lowlands, we don't have enough room for cemeteries. And so the norm is now the crematorium.
Yes, the crematorium. And they have beautiful, gardens that your ashes can be buried in or scattered in.
Yep. Up in the Highlands, of course, where there aren't any crematoriums, but there's plenty of space, it would still be the norm for people to be buried. So big Highland funerals in the villages and towns up there.
Yes, and I looked at the cost of, if you wanted to buy a burial plot now, for a family lair, I think it's about £800 to £1,000 you can get it. And in the old days, it used to be cost, you'd say, with so many rooms in it.
Right.
So you quite often see a grave marker that says, two rooms or three rooms just in the lair. But I think many people are being cremated now.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that you lose are the headstones, the heat stains,
yes,
as it'd be called, because that tells the story. And if you go into any old graveyard in Scotland and walk around it, you'll see people either dying very early, through war, through illness, infant mortality. But those that survived went on to live to a ripe old age. So it's really interesting to go around, not only to look at the names and the stories that they tell, but also all the carvings on the gravestones.
Oh, that's a whole new episode, isn't it? The grave marker. I don't know what you call them.
It's memorai,
yes,
something. We'll find,
yes,
that out, and that's another episode.
Yes.
So much. Yes. Who would have known it?
But Liz, I think we're almost at word of the week, aren't we? We've said quite a few during the course of our blethers.
Well, it was just when we were thinking about Edid Wi, when he was fighting, a couple of words that we use still to this day, it's a sair fecht.
Oh, yes.
If something's a real struggle, it's a sair fecht, a sore fight. So if somebody, had a really hard time at the end of their life, it was a sair fecht, a sore fight, a sore struggle.
Yes, well, and I love that. You do still hear that, you just say effect. But I was really struggling with the word because I think we've used them in the thing. I was going to use lair, but did we know that's the Scottish word for the plot? But just a wee story attached to that. I mentioned there was a family lair up in Dundee, and I know that my aunt would never go up to look at it because there was a gap. It was, I think there were six names, but there were five names on it already, and a gap where her name would go when she died. She just didn't like the thought of that on the family lair.
She was the opposite of Archie because he was making sure his name went on.
That's right, yes. So, well, Liz, thank you very much for our little venture into the death customs of Scotland.
It was interesting.
It was an interesting one. Okay, well, bye everybody.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye.
And there we have it, the end of another episode of Scottish Blethers. If you'd like to join us on social media, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as @ScottishBlethers. And if you'd like to leave a review, please do so on your podcast platform of choice. It's cheery bye from me.
Ta-ta the moo from me. And if I don't see you through the week, I'll see you through the windy from me. Bye.
See ya.
Bye.